Thank you, Mr. Solicitor General. Mr. Bickle.
Mr. Chief Justice, may I please the court? We began publishing on June 13th. We published on the 14th and the 15th with no move from the government till the evening of the 14th, despite what is now said to be the gravest kind of danger, which one would have supposed would have been more obvious than it turned out to be.
Well, Mr. Bickle, aren't you going to allow some time for somebody to really see what this means before they act? And
Mr. Chief Justice,
the meeting is drawn and get lawyers into the courts?
I plan to return briefly to this point. I point out now only that, as was evident to us at the hearings when we cross-examined some of the government witnesses, high-ranking people in the government quite evidently read these things on Sunday morning, the following day, and no great alarm sounded. I mean to return to the significance of this point as I see it. I mentioned it, by the way, now only in the process of reciting the chronology. We were then enjoined under prior restraint on the 15th, and we have been under injunction ever since. It's the 11th day, I guess, under the order of the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. We would remain under injunction presumably till the 3rd of July, with the distinct possibility of more time added after that if appellate proceedings are required. Now, a word simply on what was had before the hearing that was had before Judge Gerfein. It took place on Friday last, I believe. Started first thing in the morning with open hearings. We went in camera, as Mr. Seymour said, for something upward of 4 hours. I don't know the exact time. The record will clearly show that the judge's sole purpose in camera and continuously expressed intent was to provoke from the government witnesses something specific, to achieve from them the degree of guidance that he felt he needed in order to penetrate this enormous record. It is our judgment, and it was his, that he got very little, perhaps almost nothing. The point, however, that I wish to leave with you is that at no time in the course of these hearings did the government object to their, what is now called, the speed, the rapidity of them. At no point was more time asked for. Of course, we all labored, as I think is only proper, under the knowledge that a great newspaper was being restrained from publishing and that expedition was desirable. But there is no evidence that I know of that Judge Gerfein rushed the proceedings or would have rushed them if the government had asked for more time. I think the government gave Judge Gerfein all it had. Now, the government based its complaint against us, framed in very general terms, on a statute. First one section of it, finally section 793E of the statute. We have a substantial portion of our brief that is still devoted to arguing that that statute is inapplicable. Judge Gerfein so held it to be, and I take it that the order of the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit is at least open to the interpretation that that holding of Judge Gerfein's is, if not affirmed, at any rate, accepted. If I may at this point take up Mr. Justice Stewart's question to the Solicitor General, referring to our position. We have all along in this case conceded for purposes of the argument, that the prohibition against prior restraint, like so much else in the Constitution, is not an absolute. But beyond that, Mr. Justice, our position is a little more complicated than that, nor do we really think that the case, even with the statute out of it, is a simple, presents, indeed, a simple question of fact. Rather, our position is twofold. First, on principles as we view them of the separation of powers, which we believe deny the existence of inherent presidential authority on which an injunction can be based. First on those, and secondly, on First Amendment principles, which are interconnected on both, and which involve the question of a standard before one reaches the facts, a standard on which we differ greatly from the Solicitor General. On both these grounds, we believe that the only proper resolution of the case is a dismissal of the complaint.
What was the first ground?
The first ground, which I'm about to enter upon, is a question of the separation of powers. With the statute out of this case, as I conceive it, Mr. Justice, the only basis on which the injunction can issue is a theory, which I take the Solicitor General holds, of an inherent presidential power. Now, an inherent
based upon
his constitutional
the power of the executive in the area of international relationships and in the area of the defense of the nation.
I so assume.
Under the Constitution of the United States.
I so assume. The reason for that being that a court has to find its law somewhere, as Holmes would have said, I suppose, that some legislative will must be present from which the court draws the law that it then applies. And that legislative will has to be the president's if there is no statute. Now, I don't for a moment argue that the president doesn't have full inherent power to establish a system of classification, that he doesn't have the fullest inherent power to administer that system and its procedures within the executive branch. He has his means of guarding security at the source. In some measure, he's aided by the criminal sanction. But anyway, he has full inherent power, and the scope of judicial review of the exercise of that power will presumably vary with the case in which it comes up, but I'm prepared to concede the decision in the Epstein case, for example, which is cited, I think, in both briefs that under the Freedom of Information Act, the scope of review is limited to examining whether it's offered. Nor do I argue that the president doesn't have standing in the sense in which Baker and Carr distinguishes between standing and justiciability. Standing to come into court, which is, I think, the burden of most of the cases that the government cites. The question that I do argue is whether there is inherent presidential power to make substantive law, not for the internal management of the government, but outlooking substantive law, which can form the basis for a judicially issued injunction imposing a prior restraint on speech. Now, the decisive issue that ties in this point and our ultimate First Amendment point is, of course, the exception carved out by Chief Justice Hughes in Neary, Minnesota, for that narrow area in which he accepted that a prior restraint on speech might be applied. This is an exception that is made to a rule more solidly entrenched in the First Amendment than any other aspect of it, a rule that is deeply part of the formative experience out of which the First Amendment came, the rule against the prior restraint, based on the experience that prior restraints fall on speech with a special brutality and finality and procedural ease all their own, which distinguishes them from other regulations of speech. If a criminal statute chills speech, a prior restraint freezes it. It's within that well-established doctrine that the exception arises. Now, as Chief Justice Hughes formulated it, it referred to, actually said, we would all assume that a prior restraint might be possible. To prevent actual obstruction of the recruiting service, this is the Chief Justice's language, or the publication of sailing dates of transports, or the number and location of troops. I suppose that under present law, the recruiting service part of that exception is problematic, but on the sailing dates of ships and the locations of troops, there is a very specific statute. It is 18 U.S.C. 794, which isn't cited at hasn't been cited against us, which is inapplicable, which is why it hasn't been cited against us, because that's not what we report. That isn't in our papers. Now, that being the case, there is no applicable statute under which we are covered. And the question arises, as a matter of inherent presidential authority, what kind of feared event would give rise to an independent power on the part of the president? It's the question, in a sense, that was saved in Hirabayashi, the United States, the first of the Japanese exclusion cases. And it's a question which, in its own context, of course, Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company v. Sawyer answered in the negative. Now, my suggestion would be that whatever that case, that extremity, that absolute utter extremity in which action to save for the public safety is required, whatever that case may be, in which under this Constitution, under its rules of separation of powers, the President has independent, inherent authority to act domestically against citizens, let alone to impose a prior respect, whatever that case may be, it cannot be this case. Whatever that case may be, it surely is of a magnitude and of an obviousness that would leap to the eye. And that's why, in part, Mr. Chief Justice, I mentioned at the beginning the period of time that has passed. I would suppose that, stretching our imaginations and trying to envisage that case, the one characteristic of it, suggested indeed by the example that Chief Justice Hughes recited, suggested by the phrase the Second Circuit used, which is probably why the Solicitor General resists the word immediate, the single characteristic that we can surely immediately see of such an imagined event would be that it's obvious that the public safety is an issue, that time is of the essence. I submit that cannot be this case. It cannot be that it has to take the government, which has been reviewing these documents for many months, not just in connection with this case, but in reply to an inquiry made by Senator Fulbright, as the record of our hearings in New York shows. It cannot be that a government, consisting, after all, of more than just the three witnesses, five witnesses we heard in New York, or the ones that were heard here, over this length of time, has an unfamiliarity with these documents, substantial as they might be, which is so great that when news of their publication comes up, nobody in the government knows that somewhere in those documents is one which presents a mortal danger to the security of the United States. And I would submit, secondly, that while error is always possible, Judge Gerfein and the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, which affirmed him on the record that he had before, and Judge Gazelle and the Court of Appeals here, all those judges can't have been that wrong.
Well, Professor Bickel, yeah. This isn't your case, but reading from Judge Wilkie's dissent,
yeah.
When I say harm, I mean the death of soldiers, the destruction of alliances, the greatly increased difficulty of negotiation with our enemies, the inability of our diplomats to negotiate as honest brokers between would-be belligerents. I take it you disagree fundamentally with that statement.
Not entirely, Mr. Justice Blackmun. For example, the death of soldiers. I would disagree that impairment of diplomatic relations can be a case for a prior restraint, I would say, even under a statute. I would not disagree that the death of soldiers, as in the troop ship or as an example Chief Justice Hughes gave, the difficulty I would have would be that nothing that any of these judges, including Judge Wilkie, because he, I suppose, is talking about what might yet be shown by the government, nothing that any of these judges have seen. I heard it, and everything I've read, what characterizes every instance in which the government tries to make its case factually is a chain of causation whose links are surmise and speculation, all going toward some distant event itself, not of the gravity that I would suggest.
Well, you know these records better than I do, but
we've all
again, going back to Judge Wilkie, He says, but on careful, detailed study of the affidavits and evidence, I find a number of examples of documents which, if in possession of the Post, and I repeat, this is the Post case, and if published, would clearly result in great harm to the nation. Now, I repeat my question. You, therefore, disagree fundamentally with what he seems to say.
Well, I beg your pardon, Mr. Justice. I am not as familiar as I should be with the Washington Post case. I had thought that Judge Wilkie talked about, dissented on the ground that he would like more evidence to come in. If this is a statement about the evidence that he heard, or that was heard before Judge Gazelle, then depending on what the standard is that he has in mind, I would take that language doesn't quite communicate to me what the standard is, and I doubt that it's the standard that I would contend, the narrow standard that I would contend for. Depending on the standard that he has in mind, he's either wrong about his standard or seven judges disagreed with him. But I'm sorry, I'm not sufficiently familiar with the Washington Post.
Well, Professor, your standard that you are contending for is grave and immediate, or not? Is that
the standard that I
hold for you, or
the standard that I would contend for? And the difficulties of words are simply enormous. One has to bring into one's mind an image of something, some event, and try to describe it. The standard that I would contend for would have two parts to it. One would be, and let me also say that I would differentiate between a standard applicable to the president acting on his own, a president acting in the case that was saved in Hirabayashi, for example, and a prior restraint being imposed pursuant to a well-drawn statute which defines the standard and the case. I would demand less of the statute than I would demand of the president. But the standard in general that I would have in mind would at one end have a grave event, danger to the nation, some of the things described in the top secret, in the description of top secret classification in the executive order the Solicitor General read off, would I think fit that end of the standard. At the other end would be the fact of publication, and I would demand, and this would be my second element, that the chain, the link between the fact of publication and the feared danger, the feared event, be direct and immediate.
So you, I take it then that you could easily concede that there may be documents in these 47 volumes which would satisfy the definition of top secret in the executive order and nevertheless would not satisfy your standard.
That would be chiefly for the reason that, as is notorious, classifications are imposed.
No, and my question, let's concede for the moment that there are some documents
which are properly.
They're properly classified top secret. You would say that does not necessarily mean that your standard is satisfied.
That's correct, Mr. Justice. I would say that part of the
I haven't read anything in any of your documents or in any of these cases which the newspapers suggest for a moment that there is no document in these 47 volumes which satisfies properly the definition of top secret.
That there's no document? Well, no, I don't know about.
You don't deny that, do you?
I have no knowledge. I've never been near the documents, Mr. Justice.
Well, I know, but your position must be then that even if there is a document or so, none of them satisfies your standard.
I would say that today. If asked that question on the day we appeared, on the day I appeared before Judge Gerfein on a temporary restraining order, my answer would have been, I expect not. I trust the people at the Times. I'm fairly certain not. By now, Mr. Justice, after all this time, having read the submissions of the government, although I was hit with another one this morning, not a separate submission, but an explication of earlier ones that I haven't had a chance to glance at yet. This literature, like some scholarly literature, tends to get ahead of us. Having read the submissions of the government, I am flatly persuaded that there's nothing in there, because if there's nothing that would meet my standard in there for a statute or for independent executive action. Because if there were, it surely should have turned up by now. It cannot be that after, I gather, the Solicitor General had the same experience yesterday afternoon that I saw Judge Gerfein had. Please show me now which are the three, which are the five, which are the ten, which is the most important of these. all that one ever got, all that I've ever heard, have been statements of the feared event in terms of effect on diplomatic relations. If it's a military matter, why then in terms of the addition of a possible cause to a train of a causal factor, to a train of events that's well on the rails as is, and propelled by sufficient other factors. That sort of statement is the only thing we've heard, and I would submit that that does not meet any possible First Amendment standard. It doesn't meet it either in the statement of the seriousness of the event that's feared, or, what is more important and more obvious in this case, in the drawing of the link between the act of publication as the cause of that event and the event that is feared. That link is always, I suggest, speculative, full of surmises, and a chain of causation that, after its first one or two links, gets involved with other causes operating in the same area, so that what finally causes the ultimate event, it becomes impossible to say which the effective cause was. And the standard that I would propose under the First Amendment would not be satisfied by such
And your standard is that it has to be an extremely grave event to the nation, and it has to be directly, proximately caused by the publication.
That's exactly correct.
And I gather then that your basic argument with the statutory or the regulatory definition of top secret is with the word could, because that definition says unauthorized disclosure of which could result in blah, blah, blah.
Yes, I was addressing myself only to the
defense. You would insist that it would probably result.
I would insist that for purposes certainly of any action in the president's inherent power, which is the case before us.
Now, Mr. Bickle, it's understandably and inevitably true that in a case like this, particularly when so many of the facts are under seal, it's necessary to speak in abstract terms.
Yes, sir.
But let me give you a hypothetical case. Let us assume that when the members of the court go back and open up this sealed record, we find something there that absolutely convinces us that its disclosure would result in the sentencing to death of 100 young men whose only offense had been that they were 19 years old and had low draft numbers. What should we do?
Mr. Justice, I wish there were a statute that covered it.
Well, there isn't, but we agree, or you submit. So I'm asking in this case, what should we do?
I'm addressing a case which I am as confident as I can be of anything Your Honor will not find when you get back to your chambers. It's a hard case. I think it would make bad separation of powers law, but it's almost impossible to resist the inclination not to let that information be published, of course.
As you know, as I'm sure you do know, the concern that this court has term after term with people who have been convicted and sentenced to death, convicted of extremely serious crimes, you know that the in capital cases, and I'm posing you a case where the disclosure of something in these files would result in the death of people who
you're posing
are guilty of nothing.
You're posing me a case, of course, Mr. Justice, in which that element of my attempted definition, which refers to the chain of causation,
I suppose in a great big global picture, this is no this is not a national threat. There are at least 25 Americans killed in Vietnam every week these days.
No, sir, but I meant it's a case in which the chain of causation between the act of publication and the feared event, the death of these 100 young men, is obvious, direct, immediate.
That's what I'm assuming in my hypothetical case.
I can only say as to that that it is a case in which, in the absence of a statute, I suppose, most of us would say...
You would say the Constitution requires that it be published and that these men die.
No,
is that it?
No, I'm afraid I have. I'm afraid that the inclinations of humanity overcome the somewhat more abstract devotion to the First Amendment in a case of that sort. I would wish that Congress took a look to the seldom used and at the seldom used and not in very good shape espionage acts cleaned them up some so that we could have statutes that are clearly applicable within vagueness rules and whatnot, so that we don't have to rely on presidential power. But the burden of the question is, do I assume that the event has to be of cosmic nature?
Question.
Well, no, sir. The examples given by Chief Justice Hughes himself are not. A troop ship is, in a sense, that 100 men. Or the location of a platoon is, in a sense, that 100 men. I don't assume that. I do honestly think that hard case would make very bad separation of powers law.
Professor Bickel, let me alter the illustration a little bit, the hypothetical. Suppose the information was sufficient. The judges could be satisfied that the disclosure of a link, the identity of a person engaged in delicate negotiations having to do with the possible release of prisoners of war, that the disclosure of this would delay the release of those prisoners for a substantial period of time. Now, I'm posing that so that it is not immediate. Is that or is that not, in your view, a matter that should stop the publication and therefore avoid the delay in the release of the prisoners?
Mr. Chief Justice, on that question, which is, of course, a good deal nearer to what's bruited about anyway in the record of this case, I can only say that unless, which I can't imagine can be possible, the link of causation is made direct and immediate, even though the event might be somewhat distant. But unless it can be demonstrated that it is really true, if you publish this, that will happen, or there is a high probability, rather than, as is typical of those events, there are 17 causes feeding into them. Three of those, any one of those, other than the publication, is entirely capable of being the single effective cause. And the real argument is, well, you add publication to that, and it makes it a little more difficult. I think, Mr. Chief Justice, that is a risk that the First Amendment signifies that this society is willing to take. That is part of the risk of freedom that I would certainly take.
I get a feeling from what you have said, although you haven't addressed yourself directly to it, that you do not weigh heavily, or think the courts should weigh heavily, the impairment of sources of information, either diplomatic or military intelligence sources. Now,
Mr. Chief, I'm sorry.
Oh, well, I get the impression that you wouldn't consider that enough to warrant an injunction.
In the circumstances of this case, Mr. Chief Justice, I'm perfectly clear in my mind that the President, without statutory authority, no statutory basis, goes into court, asks an injunction on that basis, that if Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company v. Sawyer means anything, he does not get it.
Well, then let me make an offer.
Whether under a statute, we don't face it in this case, and I really don't know. I'd have to face that if I saw it, if I saw the statute, if I saw how definite it was.
Why would the statute make a difference? Because the First Amendment provides that Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press.
Well,
you could read that to mean Congress may make some laws abridging freedom of the press?
No, sir. Only in that I have conceded for purposes of this argument that some limitations, some impairment of the absoluteness of that prohibition is possible. And I argue that whatever that may be, it is surely at its very least when the President acts without statutory authority, because that inserts into it as well a separation of powers.
It's a very strange argument for the times to be making, that Congress can make all this illegal by passing laws.
Well, I didn't really argue that, Mr. Justice.
That was a strong impression you left in my mind.
Well, I replied to the Chief Justice on a case that arose without a statute and tried to distinguish. It is crucial for purposes of this case to distinguish between the authority which is here claimed of the President to act independently without a statute and the possibly greater authority of the whole government through the machinery of legislation to act in similar premises, of which I concede nothing that I don't have to, Mr. Justice.
Professor Bickel, I have one question that's prompted by this exchange. Generally speaking, there are, as I understand it, no statutes granting immunity to newspaper reporters from disclosing their sources, but there's a firm claim made by newspapers, by reporters, and there have been a number of cases on that. And if I read the briefs and the accounts of those other cases in California and several other places, the claim of the newspaper is that the First Amendment protects them from revealing their source even to a grand jury, you know, the investigation of criminal matters, because otherwise the newspaper sources would dry up. That's generally the thesis of the press, is it not?
Well, there are some cases that are on this court's docket, as you know, Mr. Chief Justice, for next fall. One of them, with which I'm most familiar, is the Caldwell case from California, in which there was a refusal to reveal sources upheld by the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, even to the point of not requiring an appearance before the grand jury. But the claim is very substantially qualified. That is to say, Caldwell holds, one doesn't know how far that might be taken, and perhaps some of the other cases will require the argument to take it somewhat farther. But Caldwell, on its own, holds that in circumstances where the government, as indeed Attorney General Mitchell's regulations themselves provide, which were issued after the Caldwell case started, in cases where the government hasn't shown a clear necessity for the evidence, hasn't shown that it hasn't been able to get it elsewhere, hasn't shown that it's central, inescapably central to the proof of whatever crime it is that the grand jury is investigating, that in those circumstances, where the claim of confidential communications is made by the reporter, there is a sufficient First Amendment interest to protect that claim on the theory that if confidential sources dry up, and the theory runs would dry up if there were no protection of confidentiality, there would be a diminished flow of news.
Yes, I know that the argument then is that the newspaper reporters claim for themselves a right which this argument now would deny to the government.
I know there's an appearance of unfairness or unevenness about it, but I think the answer that a reporter would make, and an answer that I find wholly persuasive, is that neither in this case nor in a case like Caldwell does the New York Times or does a reporter claim something for himself, but rather that the claim is made in order to vindicate the First Amendment and those interests which that great document serves. Thanks.
Thank you.